Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Fighter's Voice with Don McGuire, presented by Finished MMA and the United Way Merced.
Welcome to The Fighter's Voice. I'm your host, Don McGuire. We have a really unique show for you today. The individual that is coming on my show today is talented and multifaceted, and I found it was so intriguing that I had to share her with my listeners and the fans of the show and the sport. You know, when you look at life in general, anybody that does more than the average person, as I was speaking with our guest, you know, is entitled to a voice, and a voice is one that I feel must be heard if it's speaking eloquently and so essentially about something we all love. You know, this guest is an author, a fighter, but has so many more aspects to her, and it's truly an honor for me to have her on my show today. With that being said, hopefully I get this right. Sign Knight, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
The honor is all mine, the honor is all mine. You know, we'll get to the book in a minute. You know, I kind of want to touch on, you've dabbled in a wide range of the sports, including Chinese martial arts, Muay Thai, Judo, BJJ, boxing, and even fencing. You know, what is it about the sport that truly drew you in, and you've seen the passion, the desire for yourself, just not in life, but in the path moving forward?
I suppose how I got into martial arts was in a sort of interesting way, because my mom was actually a professional dancer, and when I was a child, I have a brother, and she wanted, I guess because I'm the second child, she thought I was going to be a dancer like her. And then she took me to dancing class, which didn't really work out, and somehow we landed in martial arts class, and that just took off really well for me, which ironically my brother quit in 3 weeks, and I lasted the rest of my life. And it started really with Chinese martial arts, because where I was from is one of the most common sport, and in the process of learning the sport or practicing, you know, I find it really difficult to try and explain Chinese martial arts in a Western context or a non-Chinese context, because it's quite complicated itself in terms of how we practice and how it, the history of it and what we actually practice. However, in modern day Chinese martial arts, what was really taken out of the training process is actual combat, which is in some ways ironic, because it almost becomes a show performance that you never have any real combat. And I did that most of my life, and I even tried fencing, because I trained a fair bit in Chinese martial arts in weaponry, because it's common that you do without weapons, with a short weapon, which is like a sword or a saber, and then a long weapon, which is like a spear or a cudgel. And so I was quite big on the broadsword, and therefore I thought maybe I should, you know, try in a combat sense, and did a bit of fencing, which astounded me, because I would have expected that you need a lot more upper body strength for fencing, but the reality is actually most of the power comes from the legs, in a way like boxing, where people think it's all about your punching power, but leg work is extremely important as well. So eventually I got more and more curious about actual combat, because I've learned to, you know, theoretic combat for a long time, and somehow I stumbled upon a Muay Thai gym in Australia, and then I started the class, and they had real sparring experience, and I thought, oh my goodness, you know, everything I thought I knew, I don't know anything. And from that point on, because that gym was actually Muay Thai and BJJ predominantly, and then they branched off to judo and a little bit of boxing because of the instructor that came in. One of the judo instructor was actually a four-time Olympian in judo, who eventually became a UFC fighter. And then one of our Muay Thai instructor was also a former world champion in both Muay Thai and boxing, and therefore they brought a huge skill set to the gym, and that's how I, you know, got into the actual combat sport. And then, you know, with such a two good trainers, I really just circled around the gym trying everything, even though I say I started off mainly Muay Thai, and I think I did that more than the other ones. Though when it was time for me to consider actual competition, I was a little bit too scared to go to Muay Thai, or I did, but just one in the club, which I was... I lost miserably, and then from that point on, I thought, oh, maybe I'll just go boxing because it's one less element to worry about. And I've got into a couple of amateur fights, and I've got to admit, I'm probably not a very good fighter because I don't think I've ever won anything major, but the experience of the actually having the experience of going to the fight really opened me to a world that, you know, I could never imagine, and it allows me to look at fights and tournaments, whatever the skill, whatever the genre is, whether it's mixed martial arts or judo, I just look at them completely different from that point on. Especially, you know, not just the actual night itself, but the whole weight cut and your health and looking after everything all the way to the end of the fight. It's something that I would never be able to imagine. So I look at all the... I watch matches on TV with a fairly different... from a fairly different point of view, having experienced some of it myself. And so that's kind of my background in martial arts, which is more of a fine
love. Yeah, right. Well, you know, would you say that it was the traditional aspect that profoundly inspired you, or would you say it's the bravery and the hardships that fighters endured that allowed you to focus this passion?
Well, because I have tried a fair bit of martial arts, I've came across so many types of people, so many different personalities. It is quite fascinating. I would say one underlying factor for all of them is courage, because whether your competition is like a show performance, which is what modern Chinese martial arts is mostly these days, or actual combat in a cage, or, you know, everything in between, or fencing in a way, which is sort of somewhat cross because it's more controlled, I think nothing can really explain that anxiety or that fear just before you enter the showground or the fighting ground or the arena. It's just that fear is just quite extraordinary for me, and because I've experienced it for myself, and when I watch other people go in, you can just see that transformation before they enter. So, and because I have the honor to actually witness quite a lot of them during training before they go into a fight, I remember seeing, you know, one of the fighters in my gym, and he was going for Australian Fighting Championship, and he already lost to this his opponent one time, and then he was going really, really hard, trying very hard to, you know, for the rematch, which unfortunately he lost again. But during that process of watching him train for it, I sort of know that he wasn't just conquering his fear of going into the cage, he was conquering a fear of actually fighting someone he's lost before, which adds an extra dimension. So there's so much of this courage that I see around me, which, you know, I just suddenly feel really, really humbled. And in talking to them, most of them don't think about that as very much. They're very focused on the fight that's coming or whatever they're training for. They don't think of themselves as, oh, look, I'm so hardworking or I'm so courageous. And I guess that makes it even more humbling. And the other thing that I guess always touched me is comes from some of the stories that I know from the people that I've met, or also from a lot of well-known mixed martial artists, which is how most of them came from, like the cliche story of the whole redemption, martial arts takes you on a redemption journey. It's sort of a cliche, but in a way, it really works out for a lot of people, because whatever they are actually fighting internally, whether it's something really traumatic like, you know, childhood sexual abuse, to maybe just you're not particularly happy with your life in general, even if you're on a 9-to-5 job and you're just not seeing yourself going anywhere, you know, for both ends of the scale. Somehow when you start training for martial arts, it gives you a very different sense of focus that just transforms a person on so many levels. And the most obvious one is usually physical, and it gives them confidence and a sense of purpose in life. And I just find it extremely fascinating how a sport can take so many people on so many levels to a height that they could possibly never imagine themselves before.
I like that. You know, I'm going to kind of take us off topic for a second. You know, people call me the Barbara Walters of MMA, and I apologize. It's just because I like to have a unique platform. Sometimes I share different aspects of life. You know, I had the privilege and the honor of having Crew Yawadi Hurst on my show. And the reason I find this prevalent is because she was the first woman crew ever indoctrinated into the Muay Thai Grandmasters. And she did this at 28 years of age. And if you were to ever see a picture of her, you would see this little itty-bitty thing. But what even astonished me more about the interview that I had with her, and this is why I'm a traditionalist at heart myself, and I hold the core traditional values of the sport very near and dear to me. Her father was a monk, and they lived in Thailand. And as most people in the States won't realize that, you know, in Thailand, when your father's a monk and the regular general population, the daughter isn't supposed to do things like this. You know, they kind of frown upon you if you're a fighter, or you do this or you do that. But she went with her passion. And on her father's deathbed, she went to him and she said, you know, I'm sorry I disappointed you. And he said, you never disappointed me in life. And she said she was kind of amazed. And she looked at him and she said, you know, what can I do for you, father? He said, I want you to teach me Muay Thai. And
in that moment,
you know, for a Shaolin monk to tell his daughter, I want you to teach me Muay Thai on his deathbed, was basically his way of saying, you know, I believed in you all the time. I have faith in you. I respect you. When you hear of stories that are true to life like that, how do they inspire you, Sain?
Well, the lady you spoke about, I suppose, gave her an extra dimension because she's a woman and came from an Asian background. And for me, I can relate a lot to that. Let's just say women in general going into martial arts. Generally, you get a lot more, I'm not sure what the word to use is, judgment, maybe, for taking up a sport that is unusual. And much as you think that if you, in general, you think in life that somebody goes beyond what is commonly expected of them, or what goes beyond what generally is expected of their age or their gender, you think it's a great thing and you should have respect for them. But instead, when a woman, you know, tries to go beyond what is expected, you know, they're meant to be, supposed to be protected, or at least and not be physical, but if they transcend that and actually go fighting, instead of respecting that, at the beginning they do get a lot of judgment to go, why are you doing this, or and you're not ladylike, etc. And in Asia, I guess it's almost that judgment is twice as harsh. So for someone like that to defy a father and the society in general, it's a kind of courage that I think is quite beyond me. And then to reach a really, you know, historic level, to go on to some kind of Hall of Fame or become a historic figure, that is just fairly mind-blowing in the way I see it.
Yes. It truly inspired me. And, you know, I've had her on my show a few times. And, you know, it's an honor to have you on, because you look at the resume that you have, but yet you speak so lowly about what you've accomplished. You know, I find it tremendous that you... We're going to kind of touch on your book just a little bit right now, and then we'll get deeper into the subject as the show goes on. But, you know, the trend and the growth of female cage fighters on a global scale, it's not only left a profound mark on you, but many old-timers like us in the sport that have fought so vigorously to remove the W from MMA in the sport in general. What type of profound marks has it left on you in this aspect?
I'm really quite hopeful about what's going forward. I think probably the fight against, as you said, the W in MMA or the fight against the W in any sport, you know, it's accelerated quite a lot in the last few years, which I find really impressive. Because I always see 2012 a very turning point in women in combat sport, where boxing was first inducted into Olympics and UFC had their first title fight. And then from that point on, everything progressed rather quickly. And it's not to say nothing progressed before, but just it took a huge effort for everyone to arrive at that point. And I still remember about 3 years ago, give or take, I was trying to write articles for a mixed martial arts website for women, well, actually on a lot of subjects, but women MMA, one of them. And because of that, I have to read through a lot of social media and YouTube videos. And I noticed one significant difference from 3 years ago and today. I mean, you still see traces of that today, but 3 years ago when you see, say, for example, Ronda Rousey fight another opponent, and what people comment mostly about is what she looks like, or, you know, make reference to her body, and none of it is, or so much, there was so little talk about the actual technique or, you know, her actual training and her game plan or strategy as you would if you were commenting on a men's fight. And then, to comment on what she looks like is probably a superficial thing, but sometimes they go as far as, you know, calling names and name callings and really nasty words thrown at women fighters, which is completely unrelated to the fight. But, you know, 3 years later, I just find that almost disappeared completely. And if somebody even dares to say something, you know, non-related to the fight, that seems to get quite a lot of repercussions from social media. People frown about that. And, you know, it's quite one thing for the media or for the authorities or people in the promoters to say something about what's a good behavior and what's a bad behavior. But I think you can't particularly control social media or what people want to do or say. And I think that's the most significant improvement, which it seems to me the general consensus is that people actually respect the sport as women in mixed martial arts as it is so much more even 3 years ago, and definitely it's progressed a lot 5 years and compared to, you know, 2012 and before. It's just, for me, I find a very, very positive thing, and I have so much more to look forward to in future. And I joined some mixed martial arts discussion group, and, you know, I find that it used to be like you feel like a woman has to jump in and throw in a women's fight to have a debate, whereas nowadays male fans actually bring up the names themselves without, how should I say, and nobody actually think very much of it. So I think women in mixed martial arts or women MMA or MMA in general seems to really lead the pack in a lot of other sports, because I definitely don't see that in Australia. It's Australian footy or AFL, similar to the NRL in America. And women AFL has came a long way, but I think in terms of standing on the same platform, they still lag behind mixed martial arts. And tennis is even more bizarre because, you know, you have the likes of Serena Williams being around for decades and still they're still literally, still having, you know, arguments about equality. Whereas mixed martial arts seems to really lead the pack in having a more equal standing between male and female. And I think for that, I feel almost proud, even though it's not much to do with me, but I feel really happy about it.
Yes. There's two issues that your statement has brought to mind, and I hope you don't mind me kind of differing from the trail that we originally were planning on going. We'll get back to it, I promise. You know, the one thing, you know, to bring up, to retouch back on your statement of, you know, women's mixed martial arts, you know, a lot of us old-time people, I've been in the sport for 21 years, so a lot of us old-timers that were around, I've been around since UFC 3, and, you know, I was predominantly a photographer in my life. I still am, but the radio show is something I felt I needed to do to get back to the sport that, that made me. But there was an issue that, that has been coming up on social media, and I want to get your respects on that because, you know, here, us pioneers, we fought so hard to get that W removed from the MMA. But then you go and you see these fighters that are tremendous in ability, tremendous, you know, warriors in the octagon, and, you know, you go on social media and they're posting pictures of themselves, you know, half naked, and to me, it's disrespectful. But, you know, you look at the sport as an entirety. You go back to UFC 194 with Conor McGregor, where the sport truly took an entertainment aspect. Do you feel that women fighters posing half-nude on social media is taking away from the true value of a woman warrior that has have paved the way to the sport where she's at today?
I actually agree with you, and I know what you're trying to say, and maybe it's harder for you to say because you're a man, and, you know, it's almost as though, not quite the same thing, but similar, like if you're a white guy, you can't talk about racism. But I do know what you're saying, and I actually agree with you. And it's one of the aspects I did mention very briefly, I was trying to bring up in the book anyway, which is... it's funny because yesterday I put up this video on Facebook, and it was about this comedy on BBC and this woman on race news channels telling the world to, well, to F off because women need to stop being judged. And then a male friend of mine commented to say, actually, women judge women most. And I said, actually, that's quite true. And it's interesting because when it comes to, I'm not sure if I want to go use the word discriminate, as harsh as discrimination, but let's just say in terms of as far as the gap is concerned, I find in some ways women are quite responsible for some of their, well, rather some women are also responsible for the overall inability, not inability, the overall lack of progress. And I understand why a woman wants to, you know, show their bodies to the world in a more sexualized context, because if you work so hard to make your body look so great, I can understand why you feel really proud and you want to show it off. However, I guess in the context of an athlete, it is a slightly different thing. It's quite one thing if you're an actor or you're actress or a model, but when you're job is not related to the way you look, then it does make a very interesting or how should I say, at a dimension which I'm not fully comfortable with, because as you just said, everyone has fought so hard to remove the W in mixed martial arts, but it's almost as though when you sexualize your image, you're putting it right back. Because, you know, how I saying it, just as recent as 3 years ago, when two women are fighting, you get people commenting on YouTube about how they look, or, you know, who has the biggest curves and who look prettier, and, you know, oh, I hope she loses because she's not as hot. You know, comments on things like comments like that are just unrelated to the sport. And when you try to bring a sexualized image back to yourself, it just kind of, you're bringing that, justifying that, you know, how should I say, people judge you by your looks. And I suppose, I mean, this whole visual thing really does cut both ways, because I guess we do see in general in society always favor the better looking. It's not, I don't think there's anything new or something that we can stop entirely. But I guess it's one thing to be the better looking person versus, you know, a highly sexualized, charged image of yourself, which I do disagree with. the former, I guess, you know, I can see why you want to show off in a way. I don't think there's any harm in that. But when you actually sexualize the image, then that to me is a regression, not a progress. So I know what you're saying, and I do agree, and I know it sounds terrible, but I wish people would stop doing that.
Yeah, so do I. I mean, you know, I stopped shooting ring girl contests years ago, and, you know, I'm 51 years of age, so I look at life in a whole entirely different aspect in retrospect. You know, Simon, when you sat down, you know, sometimes in life we sit down and we look in a mirror, or we're walking down a pathway and we look in a puddle and we get a reflection of who we are or where we need to take our life. What was that reflection that had you create and put out Girl Fighter? What was the inspiration and the reflection that came through you into your book?
Well, there are two main aspects. One is slightly longer term, and one was the trigger or the moment of inspiration. So the former was, I think I've always wanted to write, and I would like to write about underrepresented or misconstrued subjects in society, because as you know, in this particular context, for example, the two main subjects of the book is, one is about fighters, and yes, it's a women fighter, but specifically fighters. What society thinks about a martial artist or a combat sport fighter is that, you know, they're violent, they are probably not very clever, and always using their muscles and not their brains. So these are very cliche thoughts of a fighter that society imposes onto combat sport athletes. And the reality is a lot of them are a lot more complex than, or they are actually human, just like every human being is a fairly complicated thing. And one should actually look at the virtues of how they're courageous, confront their demons. And, you know, as we were discussing before, I find people who go into martial arts have always some element of a redemption to transform themselves from a life before, which is something that it's so precious, and most people really lack the courage to do so. So I think that part is something that I really want to portray. And the brain injury part, again, is similar in the way that it's strange, but, you know, we all know that it's possible for someone to suffer severe brain disorder when, you know, you throw out big names like Alzheimer's or MS. But when a person looks okay, you think that he or she should be okay. If you're such a young person, you had your brain injury, but it's not a very serious one, you didn't have half your skull chopped off, or you still look like a normal human being, but look is just look. You know, you could have memory loss and a whole bunch of symptoms that go with the injury, but because you look fine, people assume you should be fine. And if you're tired, or if you are cranky, or if you're miserable, it's just in your mind. You're not being strong enough, and it's a very harsh judgment to put on someone who probably suffered an injury as real as, I don't know, breaking a bone or having a liver malfunction, for example. So these are areas that I felt is really misunderstood or not well understood by society. And both areas, most fighters and also most people with brain injury, I find are somewhat incapable of articulating themselves. For fighters, you know, even including people like, to me, a very personal favorite is Sonny Liston from, you know, the 60s. And he is so upset the way that people portray him, but he can't really speak up for himself because he's not very eloquent, he's not particularly educated, and he's even illiterate. So he's got so much insecurity and fear that, but at the same rate, when people bag him off as a dangerous black guy, he gets upset, and then he behaves like a dangerous black guy. And I find really terrible for such a situation where he's so much more, but all people see about him is angry black guy. And then similar for brain injury people, and, you know, if you have brain injury or brain disorder, you could have just depression. People would just say things like, get over yourself. And, you know, then you said, I'm trying to get, what do you think I'm trying to do? And they get upset and they go, oh, you're truly depressed. And, you know, that goes into a spiral where, so, like I said, tragically, both groups of people I find have trouble trying to speak up or convince everyone else that I am so much more than, you know, whatever you think I am. And that's why I really wanted to portray both aspects in a book where it discusses all the areas which they are not, as opposed to what people think they are and how they react to it, and, you know, how sometimes, in a way, almost it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the trigger of how I came about putting this all this together was one day I read a book about, I just stumbled about one of these bookstores and I picked up this book, which relates to neuroplasticity, which means it defies the convention that a brain can actually alter itself or heal itself after it's suffered damages. So I thought, you know, in line with the topic of redemption, where fighters have to go beyond whatever traumatic or disastrous past that they have to redeem themselves through the fight training or to fight for, fight using the as a double meaning, where both for the actual combat fight, physical fight, and also the mental fight, to rise above everything else and be a better version of themselves, or just fight the adversary that was crippling them. So I thought, you know, this idea that you could fight to maybe change yourself or change your brain is probably harder than any cage fight you could ever encounter in your life. So I thought, when I read that book, I go, actually, you know, it is possible to change a brain, even though traditionally people think that you can't. So this is a fairly new science, and I'm not a neuroscientist. I just have to specify that. Then I start reading up on neuroscience and neurology and neuroplasticity in specifically, and there's still a lot of unknown. Even if I were a neuroscientist, I couldn't give you the crystal ball version of what's going to happen in the future. But I also know, like any historic changes in science or in human history, it requires usually a huge amount of effort, diligence, and resilience, just like what a lot of fighters have. And that's how I suddenly, you know, had the inspiration to tie everything together into one book.
I love it, you know, because, you know, the generalization has entirely been used in the focus and the format of the male fighter. You know, you look at, like you brought up, Sonny Liston. You know, I do a Legends in Boxing show, and I brought on, you know, one guest was Joey Giambra. He was defined as the uncrowned champion. He fought from 1949 to 1963. And to see what he's gone through and where he's at in life now, it's kind of disheartening in a way. And then, you know, I jumped to James Toney, former world champion of the world. I could talk to him today, and he could be perfectly fine, but tomorrow I am speaking to a totally different individual, you know, because of the traumatic brain injuries that he suffered in the ring. And then you look up to the latest of date, a dear brother of mine and another world champion being Angel Manfredi, who was just put into a mental institution because he can no longer think properly. He was allowed out, but the situation is declining. But what I love about your book is that you truly brought up the women aspect of it, because it truly has never been done before. And I've looked, and it's, you know, you're right. In health and education, the aspects of brain injury and problematic, you know, the problematic notions of psychosomatics and building bravery and confidence and resilience back in the brain is an issue that has never been brought up on the aspect of women fighters that I know of, and I've been in the sport, like I said, 21 years. So I commend you on the research. I commend you on looking into the neuroscience aspect of it. When you put it all together and you look at the finished product, how proud of you were you of your work, the knowledge that you implied in the book, and the message that you sent across to the readers?
When I had the finished product, I'm not sure how proud I was yet because I haven't you know, actually been read by anyone that's not my friend. And I guess I was only able to feel proud if the message was clear because I spoke quite extensively earlier about the message I'm trying to put across. And I think in doing that, I was less interested in what I was going to achieve, but more hopeful that somebody will listen. It all sounds very strange. And I think when I came across one or two readers that when they feedback to me, it's quite one thing to come back and say, yes, I enjoy the book. But when they came back and say, I enjoy the book for this and that reason, which is exactly what I'm trying to speak about. And that's the time where I was almost in tears. I think I was quite happy for a long time because this book took me about, say 3.5 years to write and then another 6 months or so to go through all the editing and changes and feedback. And the underlying drive that I wanted to do is, as I was saying, to put across all the messages that I discussed before. So I guess it was whether or not I consider this an achievement is secondary, more just so that I really wanted to bring the message out and for people to rethink the two aspects of it, which is how hard it is to be a fighter and how hard it is to have brain injury / brain disorder. I try to expand it to not just injury, but also things like PTSD or depression or a few other, brain disorders that was briefly touched upon in the book. Because all of them, I felt, has the same frustration to go, thinking that people don't dismiss their injuries or their disorders just because it's something they can't see. And especially if it's a young person. So I'm quite happy so far. I have a handful of people who feedback to me pretty much saying they like the book for the reasons that I would like them to like it for. And I think at that moment I was, very happy.
Yes, I love it. We're going to kind of jump away from the book for just a second here because, it was quite... knowing that you put out a public statement on your thoughts on UFC 223, if it does come to apparition between Rose Namajunas and Joanna Jędrzejczyk, social media has its ways of deciphering things, destroying things, and manipulating things, but I wanted to get your thoughts, as far as the social media aspects. And on the rematch itself, if it does occur, do you feel that it's too soon? What thoughts would you like to elaborate on that rematch, if you could, my friend?
I suppose there's a couple of things. Personally, and I'm guessing emotionally for a lot of people, a lot would back Rose Namajunas because she is the she represents a lot of really good things about the sport. One of it, is the aspect I spoke of a few times, which is the redemption aspect, that she could fight to break away from such a horrible past to become world champion. Everyone loves that story, including me, because I think if someone with such a horrible past can become world champion, then says a lot about what you can do with your life if you put your mind to it. So I think in that aspect, she's definitely, people's champion or people probably really want her to win. On the other hand, I don't particularly want to dismiss Joanna Jędrzejczyk just like that, just because before this fight, she was actually a really strong fighter and technically really dominant in that category. And in saying that, yes, she's sort of spoke up. She's never particularly apologized to Rose Namajunas, which I'm not particularly impressed with. But as everything in media, I try not to pass a full, complete judgment because I would never really know the person behind the social media. I don't think it's particularly good sportsman to not apologize when you say something this nasty, but in saying that, you know, there's so many people in the history of trash talk that probably needs apologizing if we have to stand by that standard. And I think she's technically really superior, so it would be quite presumptuous to assume that, you know, Rose Namajunas can beat her the exact same way again. Not to say the first time was lucky, but it's just that in cage fighting, anything can happen. I mean, anyone who's watched the sport, especially like someone like you who's watched it for 21 years, I'm sure you've seen a fair share of just impossible wins. Nobody expects this person to win. And somehow the win was spectacular. So it's so hard, almost impossible for anyone to go into a fight and say, I'm pretty sure this person will win. Anything can happen, really. So I think it would be too early to hope for anything. And when I said too early, I think when it's too early all the way to 2 seconds before the fight, it's too early to say. And
you know,
the other thing is, sorry, you go.
Oh, no, go ahead. I apologize for interrupting.
Oh, no, no. The other thing is, I remember somebody brought this up in a debating group yesterday, and he was saying he thinks it's not a bad idea. Whether win, lose, or draw, I mean, no draws in UFC, but win or lose, he thought maybe Joanna Jacek should move up to flyweight. And then, you know, you have two really strong fighters in two weight divisions, then you'll be exciting. And I said, well, it's good for the sport. Yes, I actually agree with that. Because if weight cut is such a big deal for her, then maybe you shouldn't cut so much weight. And when I rewatched the match, I thought, just visually anyway, you know, it does appear that Joanna Jacek looks actually quite a lot bigger than Rose Namajunas, which makes Rose's win even more spectacular because she's managed to beat someone up significantly larger than her. And that's actually quite an achievement. And not to be intimidated as well for going into the fight. So I thought, you know, if you are actually a little bit bigger, maybe you should go into the next level. Except, of course, in the next level, I think, sorry if I mispronounce her name, Valentina...
Shlemenko,
yes. It's obviously now just moved down, and she's very frightening. So I think if I was in strawweight, I'd probably want to stay there too. So that's another thought.
You know, I love your articulation of the thought, because you're right. In 21 years of shooting boxing and MMA and Muay Thai and all aspects, I've seen fighters that were put in a fight to basically be thrown underneath the bus only to come out victorious. You truly don't know whose fight it's going to be once the cage door locks, because as you stated, anything and everything is possible once that door does close. You know, my thoughts, if I can give them real quick, you look at Joanna Jacek, and you look at a lady who has predominantly ran that division for 6-7 years straight. And, you know, I love the correlation of how you put it. You know, anything can happen in any given moment. And then you dwell into it a little bit on the weight cut aspects of it. You know, this is an issue that has perplexed me, and I'm glad you brought it up, because I know certain male fighters that walk around at 220, 225, 230, but fight at 170 pounds. And I sit back, and for years, I watch these struggling weight cuts. I watch these individuals go through hell, pardon my French, but to get their body to fight weight. You know, in a medical essence, what they're truly doing is they're killing their body slowly but surely. You know, kidney functions, you know, you look at Sajara Eubanks in the Ultimate Fighter House, lost an opportunity to become a champion in the sport because she had kidney failure due to weight cuts. Do you think that this issue needs to be more addressed, not just in the aspect of the women's fighting, but in the sport in general?
I I would agree. I suppose just before I go into the details, the only exception I would, I'm not sure if excuse is the word, the only exception I think is acceptable in my mind is if you are trying to win championship in different weight divisions, which so far is not that common in mixed martial arts, just more so in Muay Thai and boxing, especially boxing. I think if I was trying to aim for a historic world achievement of world championship in five divisions, then I say, okay, I'll probably endure the weight cut to achieve that goal. But with that exception, I think in general, it's a little bit difficult to draw the limit because everyone's body is slightly different. Some holds a lot more water, some holds a lot more fat, and some holds a lot more muscle. So, you know, 175-pound man or 160-pound, 135-pound woman can look so different. So I suppose weight is just one aspect of measuring the body. If going forward they want athletes to be more healthy, maybe they need to introduce other aspects of measurement that makes it a little bit more fair. But it's quite one thing that you go through an extremely unhealthy practice to cut your weight down to a level so that you can have an advantage. Either you don't want to have an advantage over your opponent, or you simply do not want to be disadvantaged. It almost comes down to that you don't really have a choice anymore, because if, you know, both of us work around 160, but we both fight 135, and one day I decide I'm not going to fight 135 anymore, I'm going to fight 160, whereas the woman in 160 usually goes around working 185, and just go, well, that's not going to work very well for me either. So if everyone does it, then, you know, it's almost that you have to really go against a harder fight to win, which then kind of makes it unfair. So until, you know, the sport itself or the association steps in and actually throws in a few more, how should I say, measurement techniques or rules pertaining to this aspect, then it's hard to expect the athletes themselves to self-correct because, as I said, you know, why would I want, if I don't cut, I have to fight someone who's working around 20 pounds heavier than me, and it's not something that I probably want to go into unless I'm an exceptional fighter, which doesn't happen very often. So I'm kind of with you on this because it's similar to brain injury and a whole lot of other injury. It's a big deal about athletes' longevity. I think, well, you have watched fighting a lot longer than I have, and I think you've seen the aftermath of people in post-retirement where you were saying how, was it James, Tony, that some days you see him really well and some days not. And, you know, if he had been better looked after when he was in the prime of his game, then he may not have been this bad now. So weight cut is almost like, you know, it's getting more and more serious these days. I'm sure when it started, it was more just, I have 2 extra kilos of water, I'm going to cut it down to whatever, versus now I'm trying to gain a huge advantage over my opponent by cutting 20 pounds. So it came a long way, but it's, I think, a time where probably you need a lot more health checks or a lot more checks in place to ensure that the health of the athlete is not damaged permanently, because already the lifespan of an athlete is short. You don't want it that in their very short career they destroy their body for the rest of their life, which is just, you know, terrible in every sense.
Yes, it truly is. You know, you've been profoundly inspired by female cage fighters on a global scale, their hardships that they've endured, you know, through bravery and all aspects. When you look at that part, and then you look at the confidence and the resiliency from the sports, you know, from women that, you know, have put themselves in the sport application, how much of that did you pull and contrive from yourself and put into your book?
I would say probably I have experienced everything on a smaller level, and I just use my imagination to imagine it to a more grand level, if that makes sense, which is I think we touched upon in our discussion a few things. One of it was, say, defying your social expectation that, you know, women shouldn't fight. And then initially, this book was set in 2010, so this was before women mixed martial arts were in mainstream. And the fights are considered not important, and you think, I work so hard, but you don't think I'm important, which is a bit demoralizing. And then the other thing is more generic to, I think, a lot of fighters, because it surprised me. I mean, it surprised me, it don't surprise me, that a lot of fighters, including veterans who are now retired, still either have to, either struggling for money or just having very normal, very average jobs, and they still struggle with the finance in spite of achieving some amazing heights in sport. So another thing is I guess what people take back from that is don't quit your day job even if you want to be a combat sport athlete. So that aspect is very difficult, because if you want to have a day job and become a combat sport athlete, you pretty much have no social life. And that's a very, very isolating period for a long time. And, you know, as everyone else in life, if you've been socially isolated for a long time, it causes problems, both mentally and also a whole lot of other problems that come with being isolated. So that's another aspect that I personally felt, because not that I was ever a professional fighter, but, you know, in the days where I trained really hard, maybe, say, you know, 5-6 nights a week, I have no social life to speak of because I'm tired when I'm not training or working. And I can't imagine if you were actually doing this professionally. So, like I said, I personally experienced it, and I tried to blow it up a notch, or maybe 10 notches, to go imagine if this I was doing even at a higher level. And then the other thing that we spoke about was women sexualizing themselves, which is my personal peeve a little bit, because not that I was ever professional, but, you know, I'm training really hard. You know, I'm in a gym where, you know, it's 10 men to about one woman, and men don't want to spar with me. And when I want to spar, when I'm always in match with a girl, they just go, "You're a girl, she's a girl, you go with her." And then, but she's rubbish, she's just new. I'm an experienced fighter, I don't want to spar with somebody new. But, you know, it's like, because you're a woman, therefore you have to spar with her. And I said, well, why is it like that? I get very annoyed, and I always have fights with my instructors about that. I said, I'm experienced. You should match with an experienced person. You know, that boy is inexperienced. Match him with an inexperienced girl. Why am I being, you know, boxed up by my gender? And also then girls who go to the gym because they want to flirt and not want to actually train. And I just go, you know, like, for the life of me, I've worked so hard to try and be a normal athlete here. I really don't want this woman coming in and, you know, dressing up in low cuts and wearing makeup. It's almost like, almost like a regression to the sport or to our position in the gym. And then, you know, then almost in that way, in a much smaller scale, not in a social media scale, suddenly all the boys in the gym are very interested in the nice-looking girl, and then you just think, you know, as we were saying, you work really hard to want this to be an equal ground and not being judged by your looks or how you dress, but, you know, somebody comes in and then just thwarts everything. So, you know, again, that is kind of like my personal experience, and I just blow it up to a few notches, and I imagine that would be what it's like for somebody professional. So a lot of the experience I actually have personally endured, but like I said, on a much smaller scale. And I believe even today, if you are a woman and you decide to take up martial arts, you probably still endure everything that I've just discussed, but just, you know, different level, and it's a matter of time on when you will experience what I've experienced. So I think a lot of changes has occurred, but until it's come down to the level of ground level, or the very fundamental basic level of newbie going into a new gym to train and experience none of that, then I think we're at the point of I'm not sure equality is the word I'll use, but, you know, equal standing or not being boxed up by your gender anymore.
Yes, so I have to agree with you, you know, but I had Professor Jenna Bishop on my show from Gracie Humate headquarters in San Diego. She's a world champion black belt practitioner. And It really did take me back a step or two when she talked about sexual and social equality not being the same for her when she walks into the gym as it is for a male in that aspect. And to be quite honest with you, I was saddened by it, because here we are in 2018. You know, you would think that issue wouldn't be so persistent and so abrupt in the gym situation, but it is, even on the world level. You know, so, my friend, you're truly a pioneer in a lot of aspects, and I'm finding just to be totally indulged in this conversation, because your thoughts are years ahead of where they should be. When you hear me speak of top black belts in the sport, top mixed martial artists in the sport, and top female boxers in the sport, feeling that there isn't equality and the same social, sexual stigmata applied to them that it is to men, what do you think we can do as individuals to create a betterment for the women and create equality for them throughout the gym and not even on a fight promotion?
Oh, that's such a great question. $1 million one. I think we can't particularly change. Well, I mean, no, we can't, right? I suppose we can. It's much harder to change society. A lot more straightforward to change yourself, I guess, as an individual, whether you're a man or a woman, or standing from a position of being a woman. I would say the first thing I try not to do is, I don't want to say I want to sexualize myself as though, because I don't think there's very particularly much meaning in that. But I do try to recognize when is it then when someone talks to me, trying to put me in a box. I don't turn around and say something angry to them, just as Sonny Liston would, because he doesn't have the, I think, or rather he just has too many people saying nasty things to him all the time. So maybe it's not easy for him to respond. But instead of responding in an aggressive way, I try to respond in a way that makes them think. So one of my favorite example was, you know, sometimes you meet someone in this social setting and then people bring up your hobbies and they say, oh, I used to fight and I love fighting and I don't fight anymore because I'm a bit old, but I used to train a lot and I have great passion in sport. And a very cliche male or female really, but mostly male response is, well, you know, you're a fighter, I better not mess with you. And I said, well, are you in the habit of messing with anyone, male or female? You're like, why would you say that to me? Because I'm in combat sport, or, you know, or I would say things like, oh, it's just do you think you're the first person who's ever brought up that thought? So instead of saying, you know, oh, don't be such a fool, or don't be such a cliche, which then they might turn around and view that as aggressive, I question them. I go, you know, are you in the habit of messing around with anyone in general, whether or not they're in combat sport? Because when you say don't mess with me, you're implying that you're messing with someone else. And everyone always just stop and think. And I don't know what they're thinking of, to be honest, but I like it that they're stopping and thinking and reflecting about what they just said and hopefully realizing, foolish thing they've just uttered to me. So I think in general, as a woman or really a man, if you're a fighter, cause someone might go to you, oh, you have big muscles and, you know, lots of tattoos. Are you dumb? Of course, I don't think anyone would say that. But like I said, instead of turning around and acting exactly like a big, angry, muscular man, you say something that makes them reflect upon what they just said and make them realize that what they just said is not very clever. So I'm trying not to act up to what is expected of me, and that's actually quite difficult, and it needs to be on. Initially, when I try to work on this reaction, it's a bit of training, but now it's come back quite naturally to me. Because even the other day, this boy was just talking about what he thinks of girls who like boys to flirt with them or something like that, which I thought what a strange thing to say. And then I said that to him. I said, really, can you please elaborate on that comment, you know, tell us about your experience of girls wanting you to flirt with them. And he just stopped, you know, like he just suddenly realized what a fool he looked like. So I think, you know, individual response is first not to ride onto that train of hate, because if you react aggressively to what is a passive-aggressive voice of you're a dumb fighter, you know, for example, that's kind of a passive-aggressive or okay, maybe very aggressive. But when someone implies that you're not very clever, or if you're a woman, you should have been in sport, sort of passive-aggressive, so it's enticing you to react aggressively. I just don't take the bait, because I think there's enough anger and rage going around. Instead of fighting aggressively to it, I just prefer that I make them think about what they just said. And whether or not then they improve from that point is really up to them. I'm not responsible for you if you choose to continue being aggressive.
I love it. You know, we brought up something a second ago that, you know, I'll be quite honest with you, because I'm transparent in life. I didn't realize the book was published in 2010. But here's where I look at the facet of you, and I see a wise soul in a younger person's, you know, mindset and body. Because most people don't realize that the first female UFC fight was 5 years ago, the 23rd of this month, and that being Ronda Rousey versus Liz Carmouche. Your book was published in 2010. We're in 2018. So you
Sorry,
go back
correct
to 2000.
You on, I'll read it.
Yeah,
Sorry,
so you go
you
back
on that.
To 2010, and you write this book with the knowledge that you already had instilled in your thought and in your heart prior. What was the inspiration? What was the thought process, or who was the guiding light, or what was the guiding inspiration for you to come up with this light years ahead of women even going into the sport on a pro level and in a pro promotion?
Sorry to interrupt you just now, but I was going to say the book was set in 2010, but it was actually published last year. So
okay.
Not that progressive. But I did start to write it in 2014, yes. 2013, that was when I started to write. I don't think I've envisaged women mixed martial arts going that quick. 2013 was, well, a year after the first UFC fight, but at the same rate, it's not what it is today. So I don't think I particularly think of the book as predictive in what mixed martial arts would be today. I think the underlying subjects I spoke about was, you know, the fighters being misconstrued as angry and violent in general, and brain injury being misconstrued as something that you just imagine in your head. And I think these two subjects, unfortunately, are still in some ways valid today. And so I guess whether or not I wrote that in 2000, I guess the interesting thing is, even though I wrote the book in 2013, published in 2017, book was set in 2010, I kind of hope the book will be obsolete as soon as possible, you know, that no longer are those points that are brought up relevant.
Well, you know, on that note, when can we expect another book of thought and life's, you know, ups and downs and perseverances and triumphs? When can we expect another book from you?
Well, I hope sooner rather than later. I do have a number of topics that I want to like to write about, but I think, as I was saying, it's one thing to have the topic subject to write about, but in this last book, it was inspired by one subject of the neuroplasticity, and that was like the lighter to the spark, or the spark to the fire. I'm not sure if it's the right analogy. So I'm still sort of searching for a spark to a topic that I would like to discuss. I would like to move away from or I'd like to discuss something entirely different. I just can't really say it what it would be. And but the last book took me 3.5 years or to 4 years to complete. I think I've learned a lot in the process of how to write, or a better way to write, or a better way to, a quicker way to edit it. So I'm hoping the next one would be a shorter period than the last one. So I'll say anything between 2 to 3 years.
You know, with the listeners that I've got now, and, you know, as I stated before, I'm also on iHeartRadio, Univision, and several other huge conglomerates as my show is in syndication. Where could the people that are interested in getting your book, where can they go get Girl Fighter? How can they get a copy of it and read it and indulge in your past writings and your thoughts?
It's available on Amazon. So there's Kindle edition, which is the ebook edition, and a hard copy that you can just order, and it will be delivered to wherever you live, really, anywhere in the world.
Yes. You know, sometimes in life we look at everything, the enlightenment, the travels, the endurances, and as I spoke of earlier, the perseverance and obstacles we have to overcome. When you look over your shoulder and you look down the path that you've traveled, how gratifying is your life thus far, and how do you feel that you best demonstrated who you are and what you would like to share with the world in the essence that you have thus far?
I suppose, well, on my personal level, it's a little bit hard to... Okay, I'll just explain. I have came from an extremely traumatic childhood myself, and I can. This is why I can relate to a lot of people, especially fighters, in the way that they seek redemption, because I think subconsciously fighting was a way that I found, or learning to fight, or combat sport training itself was a way that I found gave me a lot of peace, which again I always thought is ironic because people see that as bloody and violent, whereas for me it's a very peaceful sport. Or I found a huge amount of peace in training it, and even to some extent when I'm sparring, I find that that's when I actually achieve the highest level of calm, because I can forget entirely who I am, or whatever troubles that I have in my life, that it's all forgotten when I'm actually sparring. So I came from an extremely traumatic childhood, but I didn't become a world-class fighter, unfortunately. However, I think I'm fairly happy in the way that my life has came about, because I fought in a slightly different way, which is I made my life fairly exciting. I didn't really mention very much in this subject, but I've led an interesting life. Like, I've attempted mountaineering. I've tried to climb Aconcagua, which is in South America, twice, and failed both times, and I'm going to try a third time at some point. So I've climbed a few mountains, and again, similar to combat sport, it's enough for me to imagine what it's like to be a professional cage fighter, and I've done enough mountaineering for me to understand the life of a mountaineer, which is extremely extraordinary in a different way, completely different way. I've also tried a huge amount of things that most average people would put on their bucket list, but I've done most of it before I turned 40. Like, you know, I learned to fly an aeroplane. I didn't actually go as far as getting a pilot's license, but I was happy enough to try. And I'm a dive master in scuba, and I can play a lot of music, and I think subconsciously most of what I've tried to do is in some ways a form of redemption, of trying to break away from a lot of trauma that is buried really deep inside. And this is why one of the other reasons I think it's the book itself, in a way writing the book and also trying to explain that sort of feeling, which I'm sure a lot of women fighters or male fighters, including male fighters who experience a very traumatic childhood, can experience, which is once you've managed, no matter how hard or how tough a fighter you become, it somehow is never quite enough for you to go back in time and and I don't know, be that strong, big person that you wouldn't have, that you know would have rescued you from your traumas as a child because you were weak and helpless. And I think there's a hidden desire to make yourself bigger and better all the time and somehow never be satisfied. So the biggest fight for me, interestingly, in a parallel way, is not to become bigger and better and stronger and more intelligent, because I've done a lot of that and it's not brought me the peace that I was really looking for. I think in the end it was more of an inward looking and somehow sort of acceptance to, or self-rationalization of how things became the way they were, and in a way accepting things for what they are and trying to move on in life without trying to stop fighting against it. And that final, ironically, that final fight is actually the hardest, that transformation of yourself internally, or in the way that I projected into the book, I suppose, is like the neuroplasticity. No matter how much bigger and stronger and more intelligent you are, that last transformation that you want to break away from traumatic past is actually the hardest. So I think I had some gains in doing that recently, and that's probably the proudest moment. And the book, writing the book was a process for me because I possibly projected a lot of that journey into a story, which is not the same story, but there's a lot of parallels I drew to it. And I think there's a lot of parallels anyone who's endured a difficult past, whether it's as a child or as a young person or, well, anywhere in the distant or recent past, trying to break away from it will hopefully see some form of hope or inspiration in the book to want to inspire them on to fight on. So, yeah, that's kind of where I am in life. And I'm hoping that whatever I write on from this point would more be will also help other people or bring about other aspects of life that is different from this one.
You know, I love your story because it's truly a defining one. It's an individual who, you know, we look at life and a lot of people just are content with, as we spoke earlier, the 9-to-5. But you know, and I was going to bring up your mountaineering. You know, I had quite a few questions, and somehow the show kind of got twisted a little bit different because, you know, of who you are. You know, what you've done for women in the sport is tremendous. So, and this question wasn't even going to be planned to be asked to you, but I did a show yesterday, and it's a fighter returning to the cage and is set to fight a title fight in Hawaii next month. And, you know, people say, well, that's not much of a story, but you go back 2.5-3 months, and she had given birth to a child who, an hour after the child was born, was pronounced deceased. And, you know, I took this interview because I love doing shows that inspire and share people's stories in life, and, you know, whether it be trials or tribulations. But if you had advice from your training and your learning and your experiences in life to give back to this fighter about how life should be, because I, for one, I possibly couldn't see myself moving ahead, you know, so abruptly or quickly in life, but getting back into the cage. But I'm also not that woman, nor do I walk in her shoes. So when you look at the scenario, 2.5 months ago she lost a child, and now she's looking for life again through a title fight in Hawaii. What does it take, or what kind of passion and perseverance or a statement would you give this fighter moving ahead in life, knowing that you've dabbled in everything, you've conquered a lot that you've looked forward to, and you've done research in all aspects? What advice would you give to such said fighter?
I'm not so confident of giving advice in this aspect, because I think what she's endured is quite beyond my imagination. You know, losing a child is one of the greatest pains in life. That, you know, for some people that I knew who has experienced that will never get over it forever. But you know, it's such an amazing thing that she would now be fighting for a title, which is quite mind-blowingly. How should I say? Extremely inspiring. I think probably if I without knowing the details of what she's like on a day-to-day basis, you know, I do hope that she will look after herself more, because the grief that she's going through is beyond imagination of any rational human being. And it's one thing to step over that wound, you know, cover it up and go straight to move on with your life because you don't want to be there alone with the wound, but that is not going to go away until you actually, you know, really give it time or give it the time and the I'm not sure medication is the word, I was the healing it needs before you can really take on life again as you would as a slightly more complete person, if that makes sense. So I really applaud her for trying very hard to move on. But I hope that, you know, for her sake, she will really take a lot more time to heal herself, whether it's now or, you know, ongoing basis, because it's a really enormous pain that would take a very long time and a lot of energy and effort dedicated to just the healing of it. Because sometimes people do things as a reaction to trauma, and the reaction itself helps in some ways to move on, but it might give you an illusion that you are going forward, as opposed to it's a distraction.
You know, most definitely. I love that answer, and I'm sorry for perplexing the question on you. It just, you know, sitting here the last hour talking with you, you're a very well-defined individual in life, and the thought process that you have equated with who you are is, you know, honestly, it's mind-blowing to me. I last year I interviewed 621 fighters, and that doesn't even include my music show or the other genres that I do. But, you know, thus far, you've actually touched my soul in a lot of aspects, because you say you're not a champion. You say you're not a tremendous warrior of the sport. But in reality, it appears to me that you do your greatest work from the darkness. You know, you can shed light in life through the darkness, and sometimes, fundamentally, that's the brightest way to travel, and, you know, that's the way I live my life. What inspired you to walk that path? Because you say you're not a champion, but in my eyes, you truly are.
Oh, thank you so much. Tears coming out of my eyes. No, I'm actually serious. I'm really, really... so touched that you would think that, and really, really honored. I'm not sure if I really chose this path. I think I kind of walked it. I would like to think that, you know, I was a young girl and I thought, oh, I'm going to, you know, become a champion for the champions. I'm going to champion the path of the champions. But I don't think I did. I just stumbled along everything that I have done, as people do. I used to, you know, when I was younger, plan ahead. I said, I'm going to do this and that. But as we know, sometimes things in life don't pan out. And I don't know when is it that I stopped planning. But I don't think I've really planned where I am today. I think I kind of literally just stumbled upon it. Even the day that I took up, well, metaphorically, the pen to write the book. Well, because technically it wasn't, it was a computer. I don't think I would see this happening today. I just wrote it because I had to. And, like, you know, and even in the process of writing the book, I found it is so difficult to write. I mean, I knew it was going to be difficult, but just living the difficulty is not the same as imagining it. I wanted to finish it, but, and even if I finish it, I didn't know if it would be viewed positively, and I didn't know if I would have any chance of all in publishing it. So I had no idea. I wrote it because I had to, and I didn't know what would happen. I just hope for the best. Throw it out there and hope for the best. So I can't say I planned anything or I this was what I meant to be. I just did everything that sounded like a good idea then and hope for the best.
Yeah, well, it truly has left a defining mark. You know, to my listeners on iHeartRadio, Univision, and TuneIn Radio app and all the other subsidiaries, I suggest you go to Amazon and check out Girl Fighter. You know, it's been a tremendous honor having you on today. You know, I look at interviews as something that I take very serious in life. And, you know, I hope I gave as much to you as I've taken from you, because I truly have taken a lot away from your walk in life and in your knowledge. You truly are, like I said, you're an inspiration to me. And I don't say that to many, you know, because it's something that truly has to be profound to leave a mark. And you've done that through your book. You've done that through all aspects of the sport, all your research on traumatic brain injuries and everything leading into that, and the inspiration of women fighting in the sport. You've left a huge impact, hopefully not just on me, but all of my listeners today. And you truly have blessed my program. It's truly been an honor. I'm going to hand the microphone over to you. If there was a statement that you could make about your life and about what it has meant to you thus far, from not just for me, but for my listeners, what would that statement be, my friend? Put you on the spot.
I want to say keep fighting and never give up. This, but also give up when it's necessary to.
That's right.
I know it sounds a bit anticlimax, but it's giving in the context of the lady you just explained who just lost a child, and I think that's sitting on me and might sit on me for a while, which is yes, never give up fighting except when it's necessary to.
I love that.
And when is it necessary? So that's a statement. Yeah.
Yes, I love it. You know, and I can't wait till you get another book out. You know, I'm very honored that I was able to have you on the show and be able to share who you are. Usually, be quite honest with you, I try to keep my segments to an hour, and we got so wrapped up in conversation, we've been on almost an hour and a half, but that's fine because I'm allowed as much airtime as I want on live radio. But, you know, I take away from this interview an individual that truly cares about the life of and the rise of the woman in the sport, a person that truly cares about all warriors of the sport, and a person that just looks at life and doesn't use it in a generalized fashion. You look at life as an opportunity, and you've exploited that opportunity because you've created so many facets to who you are that you're able to share the knowledge with others, and that's a tremendous ability, my friend, and I commend you on that. I hope you enjoyed the interview that I gave you today, because I truly did, and I feel truly blessed to be able to have someone of your stature on my show. With that being said, I'm going to hand the microphone over to you. If there's any friends or family, any sponsors, or any social media sites, or just anything you would like to add to the program, the floor is yours, my friend.
Oh, thank you very much. I don't have anyone specific to thank. Just, I guess, in general, I would like to thank anyone who is working. Anyone, male, female, whatever race or age or whatever level you are at the sport, just a general thank you to anyone who is working on bringing awareness to women in sport or mental health in life in general, because both are very, it's very difficult to advocate for both. And And I would know something. I suppose I could feel something. I actually feel how difficult it is in the years that I've wrote the book and the research that I've done. So I think it's a extremely difficult journey, and I applaud for anyone who's tried to advocate for other aspects. And it's similar to the statement I said earlier. It's never stop fighting except it's necessary to have a break. So that I think that's the real important message, and to look after yourself, it's very, very important, both physical and mental health, and rest when you need to. Fight is important, but rest is also very important. So
I apologize. I was just going to say for the first 18 years of my career, I worked 42 weeks a year, and you know, as I got older these last years, I kind of said, that's not going to happen anymore. And, no. You know, most people don't know, and you probably don't even know this about me, is I'm an amputee. I'm a diabetic. I lost my left leg to diabetes. And, you know, I took some time off from the sport, and I came back. And, you know, a lot of people ask me, how was the transition? But you know what? I didn't start living until I lost my leg. I didn't get the interest or the passion that I have now in my work until after I suffered the amputation. It truly allowed me to live life. It truly allowed me to find my path. And, you know, hearing you speak today has just really cemented some of the thoughts that I've had in my head about just the generalization and different aspects that I did the right thing, because, you know, now I'm a two-time inducted Hall of Fame photographer. I'm going to be inducted for my radio show. And, you know, I didn't do any of this for that. You know, I created the show for people of the sport to give back. And my friend, you truly gave to me today. It truly has been an honor to hear your stories. I would love to have you back on in the future, as you've inspired me and my listeners, and I'm sure you've got tons of more stories to tell. And I'd be honored if you would take the time down in the future and come back on.
Oh, absolutely. I think the honor is really mine today. and I'm so glad that you take so much time to discuss, and everything that you said about me, I think, would make me lose sleep in a good way for a few more days. I'm also very happy I think the most joyous thing for me is that whether it's the book or what I said, I hope that, you know, it brings some form of peace or relief to anyone who has endured similar pains that I have, because it then makes it a little bit more meaningful. So I'm really happy that it's given you back in that area. I think that is a huge win for me. I'm very happy with that. And thank you extremely for having me here.
Oh, it's truly been an honor. You know, with my shows, I'm not trying to brag. I want to let you know the extent of my listenership. You know, I generally get 100,000 plus listens a show. Now, if there's somebody out there that is looking to, you know, ask you questions or anything like that, is there any form of social media that they can contact you on, or do they strictly go through your PR firm?
Oh, they can contact me quite easily. You just need to remember Go Find Her Book, which is all one word. So the website is gofinderbook.com. Twitter is @gofinderbook, and Facebook is also @gofinderbook. So quite easy. There is a contact form on the website anyway, and you can tweet Facebook or write to me via the contact form. So, yeah, plenty of ways to get to me directly.
Well, you know, my friend, it's truly been an humbling hour and a half with you. I could probably sit here and talk to you for another 2 hours. You've got so many stories to you. But I truly am blessed, and I thank you for taking this much time out of your day to join my show and my listeners and leaving such a profound mark. I look forward to having you back on in the future. You truly were a blessing, my friend.
Thank you, and I look forward to coming back.
All right. Well, thank you. On that note, I would like to thank you again for coming on the show. I look forward to it. I'm lost. Thank you for making my day. You truly have left an impact on me and my listeners, and I can't wait for the next book to come out and see what adventure you take us on in that aspect. With that being said, you have a good day, my friend.
Thank you, and you too. Have a great evening.
All right, you too. Bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen, Cyan Knight, author of the book Girl Fighter, so much more to her than just the book, but I suggest you go to Amazon and get a copy of the book. Tremendous, tremendous lady. You know, light years ahead of her time in many retrospects. And I tell you what, you know, there's not very many guests I have on my show that leave me walking away from a show with my head between my hands and in amazement of the knowledge that they've ascertained in such a short period of time in life. It truly was a blessing to have her on. Thank you to her management company, the PR firm, and everybody that made this possible, because it truly was a tremendous interview. And Cyan Knight, thank you. Get your copy of Girl Fighter. You truly will be inspired. On that note, I want to thank Finished MMA Juan Martinez. Without you, the show wouldn't even transpire. I want to thank the 86ers.net, Alfred and Freddie, the United Way Merced. If you can't give the United Way Merced, give to the United Way. Truly a tremendous organization. I back them. They back my show. And once again, thank you, Cyan Knight, for a tremendous interview. I look forward to having you back on in the future. On that note, I want to say good day and God bless. And take you out with a little bit of Tupac, I guess. We'll do that today. You have a great afternoon. God bless.
You are appreciated. When I was young, me and my mama had beef. 17 years old, kicked out on the street. Though back at the time, I never thought I'd see a face. Ain't a woman alive that could take my mama's place. Suspended from school, scared to go home. I was a fool with the big boys breaking all the rules. Said tears with my baby sister. Over the years, we was poor than other little kids. And even though we had different daddies, the same drama when things went wrong, we blamed.